This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Mull has used his bland suburban good looks to create quirky comedy. He now co-stars on Roseanne as Leon, Roseanne's former boss turned business partner. Back in the 70s, he co-starred in the series Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, a sicko late-night parody of soap operas in which he played wife-beater Garth Gimbel. Then Mull hosted Fernwood Tonight, a parody of The Tonight Show. In 1984, he created a series of fake documentaries called The History of White People in America. His movie credits include Mrs. Doubtfire, Mr. Mom, and My Bodyguard. Before launching his acting career, Mull did stand-up comedy and musical satire. And before he did any of that, he painted. In fact, he's still painting. His artwork is collected in his new book, Martin Mull, Paintings, Drawings, and Words. He has a current solo exhibition at the Cleveland Center for Contemporary Art. I asked Martin Mull when he started to paint.
I cannot recall a time when I was not painting. According to my parents, who are pretty much the authority on those years before the age of five, I was never without a pencil from about the time I was 3 years old on, and I can attest to recent history that that's true. I had someone come up to me the other day and say they'd never known this side of me. I don't even consider it a side. I consider it the front.
You went to college at the Rhode Island School of Design.
Yes.
What different phases as an artist did you pass through during your college years?
Oh, gosh. They went from everything from territorial to historical to pharmaceutical. Whatever phases were basically up for grabs. This was during a very libertarian time in our country's history, the late 60s, when everything was kind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So art school was definitely at the forefront of all those movements. There were times when I was very eager to jump on the current art bandwagon and to get very minimal, if that's what was happening, or to get very popish, if that's what was happening. And then ultimately, it all seems to come back down to ground zero again, and just you have to honestly deal with yourself. But I would say I went through the gamut.
How would you describe the work you're doing now?
It's extremely personal. It's more like, in a way, trying to reinvent my own being by examining those things that have happened to me over my life from a subconscious point of view. It's rather difficult to describe. It's trying to allow work to come through me, and I realize it can't come through me out of whole cloth. It has to come from experience, such as the nature of being a human being. But there are experiences that are not consciously conjured up, that they more tend to flow through.
You've said that to say that art school changed my life would be a vast understatement. It created it. How did art school change your life?
Well, gee, let's see. I'm sure that's probably more literate than it need be, but I actually do feel very much that way. I grew up in northern Ohio in a very small little agrarian community and was wearing, you know, jeans and muddy boots to school, and then I moved to Connecticut for 2 years, and all of a sudden everyone was in a Mercedes and in a crew neck sweater that cost more than my father made a year, and then finally went to art school again, and all of a sudden everyone was back in jeans and muddy boots, and I thought, well, that's more like it, and I realized that I could be an adult in that world, and the kind of questions that had kind of kept me an outsider prior to that were now not only acceptable, but necessary. And it seemed like I actually blossomed at the time. I felt like I became alive then.
How did the people around you when you were growing up fit into the history of the white man period of your persona?
Oh, my little show there, The History of White People in America. Well, I would have to say everyone I met from the time I've been born was grist for the mill, and probably a great deal of it was from northern Ohio. The interesting thing about that, I wrote those books and those television shows with a fellow named Alan Rucker, who is from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, excuse me. And one day we were sitting down over lunch and just started swapping hometown stories, at which point we realized that these two are sister cities, the same as Nice and Beverly Hills are. And out of that is what happened. What happened was that we created the History of White People in America. We realized there was a whole legacy there, and we came up with the title first and sold the series and the books without anything more than a title.
I guess it is a good title.
Yeah, it was catchy, I guess.
So what for you defined growing up very white?
Well, now to me, I've talked about this at length, and I can actually get a little bit more serious here, I guess. But
feel free to be funny, too.
Well, if I can. there's a rootlessness that whereby other minorities, and I'd have to say that the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant is rapidly screaming toward minority here in this country, as diversity seems to be taking over, whereby the traditional Jewish comic from the Borscht Belt can get up and just has a wealth of tales that go back for generations and generations and millenniums, you know, that he can draw upon. The black comedian the same way. The poor Anglo-Saxon can basically go back to about Thursday. There's very little history, very little legacy, and a kind of rootlessness that leaves us to the point where ultimately we're forced to talk about the crabgrass in our lawn or what kind of mileage we get on the Buick.
So did you come from a neighborhood where the crabgrass and the Buick were big issues?
Well, I came from a neighborhood where we knew about people like that. We were a little farther down the food chain ourselves. I actually had my best friend when I was growing up. His bedroom was made from an Amana freezer box that had been somehow duct taped onto the side of their house when he unexpectedly came along. So I guess the term white trash could be used by some, but of course I would never say such a thing.
Now, you know how you were saying that Jewish comics, black comics, they had a history to draw and they had a place to fit into, but the WASP comic didn't. So how did you go about fashioning a persona for yourself?
Well, part of my performance persona, I think, was fashioned after other performers, and especially other performers who seemed to be up the creek without a paddle, the ones that were totally at a loss. By that, I would mean like very, very local radio or television personalities. Hence, when I did Fernwood Tonight, the host of that show was one of these people who is an under-equipped, overachieving performer. That was the kind of persona I wanted to go for.
Over-equipped, underachieving.
Yes.
What do you mean?
No, you have it just the opposite. It was under-equipped and overachieving.
Oh, somebody who's getting by on very little talent.
Someone squeezing by on very little talent and trying to make the most of it. And, that may be close to the truth.
You also developed this kind of like smug, oily public, you know, persona in some of your performances?
Well, that would come hand in glove with what I just said. The under-equipped but overachieving and refusing to, just undaunted in his ability to ever admit to his failures.
And there was also the sense of, in some of the performances, the really square person who thinks he's really hip.
Exactly. Or that he's not only hip, but a major success, even when he's not. I recall once there was a concert when, put it this way, crowd control was not one of our problems.
Right.
Where I think there were only about 8 or 10 people in the audience that would have held about 25,000 or something. And my persona on stage, I immediately said something to the audience about how grateful I was that we did this by invite only. And I certainly didn't want the rest of that riffraff here. And I'm glad you all could show up. And it's sort of like making a virtue of your vice.
Martin Mull is my guest, and he has a new book that's a book of his paintings, drawings, and words. And that's, in fact, the title of it, Martin Mull, Paintings, Drawings, and Words. So is there any connection to be made between your paintings and your comic persona?
Well, I would have to say that my comic persona paid for almost all of the paint used in the making of these works. And if that sounds like a flip answer, it's actually more true than you might imagine.
So you weren't making money selling paintings?
No, not for a long time. And initially, my forays into show business were simply to fund my art. That while I was in college during the folk music scare of the 60s, when that stuff almost caught on, I, like everyone else, was playing guitar. And once I got my master's degree, realized there was nothing but, there was no doctorate, there was nothing but earning a decent living and facing the Vietnam draft at that point. I had to figure out something to do with myself, so I started playing music full time. That led to singing, where I'm a dreadful singer. So that led to talking a lot, and all of this has been kind of a comedy of errors and a series of delightful accidents that I've been able to put a roof over my family doing what I do.
Well, you know, why don't we hear one of your songs? There's a new Rhino Comedy Box anthology.
Am I in that?
Your song, Men, is in that.
Oh, no, that was written with Steve Martin, and myself wrote that together for Francis Ford Coppola.
For what?
Well, at one point back in 1975, he wanted to do, I'm sure you've heard of the Stan Freberg's History of the World Records. You must
mm-hmm,
know those.
Yeah.
Using that as a springboard, he wanted to rewrite the history of the United States for a feature film. And this was, then he got sidetracked into some little thing called Apocalypse Now, et cetera, and kind of lost interest. And plus, he wanted to do it by the time the bicentennial came around, and we finished it about a year late. But Steve Martin, myself, Albert Brooks, Harry Shearer, and a number of other people all got together and wrote a movie on the history of the United States. Steve and I were given certain eras in our country's development, one of which was Columbus finding the New World, and this was a song we wrote for them.
Oh. Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
This was recorded in, what, 1977?
Was it? I don't know.
That's what it says on the liner notes.
So. They never lie.
We'll put our trust in their hands.
Okay.
This is Martin Mull.
Captain Columbus.
Yes, Malarkey?
The men haven't eaten in days, sir.
Yes, Malarkey.
Captain, I don't think you fully understand. I said the men have not eaten in days now.
I heard you, Malarkey. Thank you.
Captain, you've gone quite mad. I'm telling you for the last time, the men have not eaten in days.
Well, force them. You've plenty of men, haven't you?
Plenty, sir.
Plenty of what, sir?
Men, sir.
What?
Men.
What?
Men.
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 Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men.
It's great to be on a ship with men and sail across the sea. Oh, we don't know where we'll land or when, but it's great to be with men.
It's great to be with men.
'Cause men can sweat and men can stink and no one seems to care. Oh, we'll throw the dishes in the sink and clog the drain with hair. Oh,
clog the drain with hair. Oh, men, men, men. It's a ship off.
Now, how did you get on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, which, for our listeners who don't remember, it was a really funny send-up of soap operas and Peyton Place?
Well, let's see.
Late night. It was on, what, 11 or 11:30?
Yes, 11. It was. It was a serial, a soap opera, really. I had gone out to California on the heels of a divorce with a couple of guitars and a suitcase and had been a big fan of Mary Hartman and went to see Norman Lear's organization about the possibility of writing for them, because I had at that point fancied myself capable of doing that and was told that there were no openings and forget it. But I did meet Norman. And then 6 months later, the part of Garth Gimble, the wife abuser, came up, and they asked me to come in and read for it, and lo and behold, I got the part. And it was somewhat terrifying in that the reason I wanted to be connected with the show was I thought it was absolutely hilarious, and that what work I had done as a comedian on stage might stand me in fairly good stead to at least cut my teeth as an actor doing something funny. Unfortunately, the role I got of a wife abuser, I personally, as I sit here right now and at the time as well, find nothing whatsoever amusing about wife abuse. So it was really learning to act a little bit by being thrown in the icy waters.
So how did you get around this?
I looked desperately for anything to try to take the focus off that which I was and that which I was doing. There was one scene, in fact, when I actually even had to, at least the camera had to think that I had actually struck this woman. And it was around a Christmas time, and I grabbed for a little, like, papier-mâché Frosty the Snowman to use as a weapon or anything like that to try to take the onus off it and the sting off it. But I recall at the end of that scene being in a state where I actually had to just go for a very, very long walk. It was horrible.
My guest is Martin Mull. He has a new book of his paintings and drawings. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor, comic, and painter Martin Mull. Fernwood Tonight was, I think, one of the early examples of television mocking
at
itself.
At its lowest.
Well, no, TV mocking its own programs. The cheesy, small-town amateur version of The Tonight Show.
Exactly.
And why don't you describe your character as the host?
His name was Barth Gimbel. He would wear lime-colored sharkskin suits and atrocious shirts, Hawaiian shirts, bleached his hair, trimmed his mustache down like Don Ameche, and basically thought, as far as he was concerned, that he was God's gift to the airwaves. And my co-host was Fred Willard, who was probably one of the best improvisational minds of our or any generation. And between the two of us, we basically set television back a quantum leap.
What period of your painting were you in while you were doing Friendwood Tonight? Were you painting then?
Yes, I've never stopped painting. At that point in my life, I was still doing painting backwards on acetate, the way cells are prepared for animation. And doing a series of paintings, mostly starring a small little wooden chair at kind of an askance angle that would be put into various situations. Smallish paintings, maybe the largest 18 by 24 inches, but all done with vinyl paint on acetate.
Now, have you over the years showed the people who you worked with in show business your paintings? And I could think of a couple of reasons why. One is so that they could be very impressed with your work. Another is so they could just learn more about you. And still a third is some people in show business are very wealthy and maybe they'd buy some.
Well, number three, I would reverse the order. The nice thing about some of the people in show business is they are kind of depression proof. They do have this kind of slush fund that allows for the buying of art. Steve Martin, whom I mentioned earlier, is a dear old friend and also one of the preeminent collectors of contemporary art in this country today, has been more than kind toward me. I think over the years he's purchased about 19 of my works, and I now hang in his living room along with the likes of de Kooning and Diepenkorn and Cy Twombly and Franz Klein, so I'm very honored about that. And Norman Lear as well has purchased some works. They've been very, very kind and very supportive.
That's great. Well, after, mocking TV on Friendwood Tonight and Mary Hartman and everything, you ended up where you are now on Roseanne, mm-hmm. one of the top-rated shows for years, the top-rated show,
mm-hmm.
Playing Leon, who you got hired to be her boss.
Right.
How did you get on Roseanne?
Well, at that time, Roseanne and Tom Arnold, who was her husband, lived a few doors away. I had known Rosie for a couple of years prior to that. We had done some local talk shows and were just kind of friendly as we met each other on the street kind of thing. He mentioned that there was a possibility, would I like to come on and play Roseanne's boss? And since at that point I was not on a series and it was the number one show on television, that was probably one of the dumbest questions that has ever been asked me. I just was basically when, where, how much, I'm there. So I took the job without even another thought. He then mentioned that there was going to be something unique about my character, in this case that I was gay, and I am not in real life, but I thought a bit about this, and on the one level, I realized that no one really believed that Eddie Murphy was Gumby, so I was probably all right in that respect. And that my real concern, however, was that people from the gay community might feel very short shrifted because, there are so many capable actors that could have played the part, and here they go and get a straight guy to play this, and that I could take a lot of heat and a lot of flack for that. But on the contrary, we've actually won awards for the portrayal of Leon Karp, and so I feel very good about that.
Martin Mull is my guest, and he has a new book of his paintings. Now, I want to go back to 1980, which I think is the year that you were diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Yeah.
I guess they were wrong.
Yeah, they were, and the Marcus Welby Award for Bedside Manner has to go to this bozo from UCLA who called me up and gave me 2 years to live over the phone.
Oh, no.
Which right there, it occurred to me, could be cause of death.
Wow.
Phone call, cause of death. That's what the autopsy would have to list. I mean, to get this kind of news over the phone, I don't know. And they were all set to inject me with some sort of cow bacillus, something that, Elsie Borden is running around with out in her limbs, and the kind of spots they have on their skin. So it turned out that actually my dermatologist had gotten all of it, but it was at that point diagnosed as terminal melanoma, and needless to say, gave me great pause. it also tended to shift my gears rather dramatically in terms of where I was going to focus my energies for those 2 years or for whatever years I have left.
So how did you change gears after you were given this prognosis?
Well, painting became the most important thing in my life at that point. And
why?
Because I realized it was probably the truest thing to me, that it was the area where I wanted to do the most work. I also shifted my marital situation changed. I shortly thereafter remarried my wife Wendy, whom she and I have been together now for 15 years, and I have a lovely 9-year-old daughter, and just kind of got my ducks in a row and put my values where I think they should be. Just, you know, a glimpse of mortality will do it.
Well, how long did it take before they told you that you were in the clear?
It was probably about 6 or 7 months before everything seemed to be settled down to the point where I actually felt I could start a James Michener book.
Right. Were people afraid to hire you afterwards?
No, because I didn't say anything. I kept it to myself.
Well, that must have been hard to do, though.
No, not really.
So nobody knew that you had cancer, and therefore you didn't have to worry about how you were going to make your reentry.
Yeah, pretty much.
How did you explain your absence? Or was nobody noticing?
Well, let's face it. There are times when I could be absent for a couple of months from any situation, and it would not be noticed too badly. I remember coming back, and Terry Garr and I did a show for HBO called Here Comes Summer. And I remember still having my back bandaged during the shooting of that. That was my first time back. So I was still fresh from the operating table, but went back to work and no one was the wiser.
Well, Martin Mull, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Martin Mull's new book of paintings, drawings, and words is published by Journey Editions. He has a current solo exhibition at the Cleveland Center for Contemporary Art. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.